Athens News Matters is sponsored in part by the WUGA Community Advisory Council, dedicated and involved individuals who help WUGA stay connected with our listeners, community organizations, and issues in the Athens area. Learn more at WUGA.org.
Today on Athens News Matters, a sales tax to fund education improvements in Clark County sails through, while Oconee County voters gave a thumbs down to a similar measure for transportation funding.
That was really an effort to transfer some of the spending for transportation from property tax to sales tax.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Alexia Ridley.
And I'm Chris Shoup. Also today, former Senator Kelly Loeffler has a new project, getting more Republicans to vote.
I saw firsthand the implications for not voting in our state.
Plus, we'll go behind the scenes with a team of art students restoring long-neglected public murals.
Those stories, plus our panel on the weekend news, coming up on Athens News Matters.
Morning Edition goes to the source, to the people affected by the news.
This plant could shut down, and a lot of very good people could lose their jobs.
Like this, it's completely ridiculous that we should feel unsafe to go to school.
I'm Noelle King. For stories that matter to you, listen every weekday to Morning Edition from NPR News.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Chris Shoup.
And I'm Alexia Ridley. Voters in Oconee County voted Tuesday to reject a one-penny transportation special local option sales tax, or TSPLOST. Like the one in Athens-Clark County that's funded projects like the Firefly Trail, fare-free public transit, and new sidewalks. Here to talk about that with us today is Lee Becker, editor of Oconee County Observations. Thank you once again for spending some time with us today.
Glad to do it.
First, can you tell me, what was the turnout for this year's election in Oconee County?
10.7% was the turnout, so pretty low turnout.
Why was it so low, and how does that compare with previous years?
Well, this was the only issue on the ballot countywide, and the only comparison that I think we can make that makes any sense at all is with the education local option sales tax, which was on the ballot as the sole item in the county. In March, and it actually had a lower turnout. It was only about 6%.
Well, you mentioned that earlier this year, Oconee County did vote to approve that TSPLOST, which is an education sales tax like the one Athens voters voted to approve earlier this week. Do you have any idea why the TSPLOST has failed to attract the same support?
Well, the ELOST was approved by 83.6% of the people. So, I mean, overwhelming support. The Oconee County Schools and Board of Education had made a very conscious public effort to launch that campaign and direct the campaign at the employees, the teachers, the others in the school, and the parents. So they really targeted the people most likely to be willing to support the tax. And it also was a continuation of a tax. So unlike the TSPLOST, which was a new tax, it was in fact not going to change the tax rate. It was only going to extend it. So those are important differences, I think. The TSPLOST didn't have anyone really working for it. The county Board of Commissioners put it on the ballot, but the Chamber of Commerce, no one else really came forward to speak for it. There were no one speaking against it. So it was kind of out there by itself. And I think because it also was a new tax, so it was going to increase the tax from 7% to 8%. So I think that is a difference, a significant difference, probably in people's minds.
And do you know what projects that TSPLOST would have funded had voters in Oconee County approved it?
Yeah, the commissioners had not identified specific projects, but four buckets of projects. The most important one was paving of roads. The second category that they talked about was intersection improvements. The third category was multi-use pass. And the fourth category was one that one would have thought would have been quite attractive. They identified monies that were in the current general fund budget that are being used for transportation. And they said that those that spending would be transferred to TSPLOST during the 5 years that it was in effect. And because of that, they planned to reduce the millage rate by 1 mil. And so we have a 6.6 mil rate in the county, and they were going to reduce it to 5.6. So that was really an effort to transfer some of the spending that is currently underway for transportation from property tax to sales tax. And I expected that that would be something that would be attractive, but I don't know to what extent people really understood that. It didn't convince the majority of people.
Lee Becker is the editor for Oconee County Observations.
Following her loss to U.S. Senator Reverend Raphael Warnock in the January runoffs this year, Kelly Loeffler has taken up a new project, getting more Republicans to vote. From our colleagues at GPB, Riley Bunch has more.
It's a Saturday morning, and Kelly Loeffler is chatting her way around a Gainesville cafe, table to table.
So we're doing poll watcher training.
Which I want to do.
Yes. The former senator hasn't announced another run for office, but she hasn't left politics either. Loeffler is on a mission to boost Republican turnout at the polls. She has poured her political power and over $1 million of her own cash into launching Greater Georgia. It's a brand new conservative voter registration and mobilization group. Why, she says, because Democrats have had a better ground game than Republicans in Georgia for too long.
It's not that we were outworked, it's that we were out-organized, we were outraised, we were out-mobilized, out-registered, and we're going to end the left's monopoly on voter registration.
But Georgia Republicans face more challenges than just voter registration. GOP leaders have a turnout crisis after former President Donald Trump's false allegations of election fraud have pushed his base away from the polls. With the former president still meddling in Georgia politics, experts are skeptical whether or not the party can fix the situation. Trey Hood is a political science professor at the University of Georgia. He says Republicans are right to be concerned.
And the question about the future is, are a subset of Republican voters, people that are very strong supporters of former President Trump, going to return to the polls?
Loeffler may know better than anyone the impact of those voters choosing not to cast their ballot. She and her Senate counterpart, former Senator David Perdue, were defeated by Democrats by razor-thin margins. But during her campaign, she too tethered herself to the former president and his unfounded claims. During a rally in Dalton, with Trump close behind her, she declared she would object to the Electoral College certification of President Joe Biden's win.
Hello, Georgia! Woo! Thank you, Georgia! I have an announcement, Georgia. On January 6th, I will object to the Electoral College vote.
But after supporters of Trump stormed the Capitol on January 6th, Loeffler backtracked on her promise. Now she walks a thin line between appealing to ultra-pro-Trump conservatives and avoiding the same false allegations of election fraud that pushed them away from the polls. Hood with UGA says the areas leaking GOP votes aren't hard to spot, rural small towns in both the north and south of the state.
You know, those are the areas that where you'd be worried about people staying home.
With Greater Georgia, Loeffler made stops in Bartow, Cherokee, Floyd, Forsyth, and Hall counties to meet with local party leaders. She painted a dire picture to attendees if Republicans don't turn out again.
I saw firsthand the implications for not voting in our state. And now Americans are feeling it, and due in large part because over 300,000 Georgians didn't turn out to vote in January.
Skeptics of Loeffler's motives have called the organization a copycat effort to high-profile Stacey Abrams' Fair Fight Action. The left-leaning organization raised over $100 million in just over 2 years since its founding. Republican efforts like Greater Georgia have years of catching up to do. I'm Riley Bunch.
I'm Tim Franks. From the biggest breaking stories of the day to the important issues and trends, we're there.
This is an historic victory and what is a very important day.
This could change world history.
Everybody's going to pay a price. He will, everybody will.
And I am just so happy to be home and to put my feet on this land again.
Another huge development.
Join me and my colleagues for NewsHour from the BBC.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Alexia Ridley. After hearing nearly 2 hours of public comment, the Athens-Clark County Mayor and Commission voted unanimously to create a civilian oversight authority to oversee the police department, sheriff's office, and jail during Tuesday night's meeting. The Public Safety Oversight Committee will review complaints concerning law enforcement and corrections officers and can advise the mayor and commission, the county sheriff, the county warden, and the chief of police on general reforms with an eye to improving the relationship between the departments and the wider community. That committee is the local government's response to mounting pressure for more oversight over the police department, especially following the 6 fatal shootings by ACCPD in 2019 and the tear gassing of protesters during the George Floyd protest of 2020. It also comes after a year of research completed by the Police Advisory Task Force, co-chaired by Mocha Jasmine Johnson of the Athens Anti-Discrimination Movement. Here to talk about that, plus the rest of the weekend news, are Chris Dowd from Athens Politics Nerd and our own senior producer, Martin Matheny. Okay, guys, there was a lot of information in that intro, a lot of much-needed background information, but let's talk about the fact that this passed unanimously. Did that come as a surprise to either of you, especially considering Commissioner Russell Edwards speculating on this show just 2 weeks ago about opposition to the measure and it possibly not passing?
I mean, I wasn't sure which way that would go. But I'm not super surprised that it was unanimous because, Chief Spruill actually wrote a letter to the commission or an email to the commission saying that he supported it. And it said that he had maybe some concerns, but he thought that those could be worked out through the process. So, knowing that, then it becomes a lot less surprising. I was never actually sure that Commissioner Edwards didn't support it. I just think that he wanted to hear from people who want him to vote yes, basically. It's almost like he was looking for political cover to vote the way maybe he wanted to vote anyway.
Now, the AADM was at that meeting to show support for the creation of the board, but Mocha Jasmine Johnson, president of the agency, has also expressed concerns with the changes that were made from the task force original recommendations. Could either of you explain what's in the ordinance now versus what was recommended by the task force?
The one thing that they added was that they expanded the board's focus to include not just the police department, but also the sheriff's office, the Department of Corrections, and I think also probation. But then they removed a lot of the more controversial elements, like they removed, all language sort of trying to determine who would be on the committee or who would be eligible to be appointed. They're just letting anyone be on it who is appointed by the mayor and commission. Even police officers or at least representatives of police could be on it. And they're going to have some non-voting members of the board. And those will include the chief of police, the sheriff, the warden. And so that was definitely added in committee. That was not in the original recommendations. And they're removing police budgeting as an area of focus. Like the original recommendations had the ability to make at least recommendations pertaining to ACCPD's budget, and that was removed in the final version. So really, the controversial things were all kind of taken out, and it's just, it remains sort of in an advisory body.
Much less controversially, the commission also approved the creation of a Human Relations Commission. Could you give us some background on what this commission will do?
So this commission will be set up to encourage dialogue about equity and inclusion in Athens, and it We'll assist residents with discrimination complaints. And they'll hold like town hall meetings. And this is sort of similar to the police advisory board. So some people might say that, oh, we don't have any problems with, you know, inclusion and equity in Athens. And this board, you know, really, it isn't for those people. You know, it's for the people who feel that there is a problem. And the goal of it is to try to address those problems in a way that it is better for everybody.
Well, also on Tuesday, Athens residents voted to renew an ESPLOST, the 1% education special local option sales tax. What projects will that fund? And Martin, can I start with you on this one?
You're getting a new Clark Middle School and significant repairs and renovations to a lot of other schools. The way this basically works, ESPLOST is a little bit different than things like, say, the TSPLOST that we're going to be talking about a lot in a few months, in that the projects that are developed are done internally based on needs. So it's not a situation where, you know, I, as just a random Clark County resident, can be like, hey, Clark Central High School needs a new band room. I mean, I could certainly express that to my school board member, but the projects are developed internally and they're done on kind of a rolling basis so that every school gets sort of a fair chance to get renovations, upgrades, and in some cases, new construction. They always buy a couple of new school buses every year. And then big technology upgrades, which I think has been put in a lot clearer focus right now because of, you know, just coming off a year of going back and forth between remote and in-person learning, and who knows what's going to happen in the next few years with the pandemic. So updating their technology infrastructure is a part of this as well.
Moving on to state news, Republican state lawmakers released their redistricting maps earlier this week. So what changes are in store for Athens if these maps are passed?
One thing that a lot of Athens residents have had a problem with our current state house maps is that Athens is included in three different state house districts, 117, 118, and 119. So the Republican majority in Atlanta has addressed that with a proposed map that carves Athens up into four state house districts now. So that's one big change. In terms of the Senate map, state Senate maps, they don't look a lot different to me for this area, but I haven't delved really deeply into those. One thing that could possibly change, one of the proposed maps they put out for congressional districts would actually put all of Athens back into a single congressional district rather than having the county split between two the way it is right now. That does not mean that if that happens, that Athens congressional district would be particularly friendly to Democrats, however.
Yeah, I know that Blake Gott has often made the point that we're not actually gerrymandered on the congressional district level, even though most people think that we are, just because no matter how you slice it, the areas around us are so red that it's not going to be a blue district. But it is concerning that, four districts for the state house, that's really, they're really stretching the limits. So, I mean, I hope it doesn't get any worse than that, but that's really bad, I think.
Yeah. I don't know what's going to happen with that map. Going back to what you said about congressional districts, you're absolutely right. There's not really a fair way to draw a Democratic district that includes Athens. By way of comparison, the last time that Democrats controlled redistricting, which would have been in 2000-2001, Athens was in a Democratic congressional district. But in order to get that district, they had to draw a district that started in Athens, had a very narrow strip of territory, then picked up Augusta, then a very, very narrow strip to connect it to Savannah. Now, that was 20 years ago, and demographics have changed, but you're absolutely right, Chris. There's not a way to not gerrymander a Democratic district around Athens. It's just the blue dot in the Red Sea phenomenon, right?
Well, finally, there's some speculation that former Senator David Perdue is considering a primary challenge against Governor Brian Kemp next year. Do you two see him as a competitive opponent?
Absolutely. I feel like the governor right now is in this sort of weird political no man's land where the extreme right of his party, the Trump base, doesn't particularly care for him because of the election shenanigans. And that extreme right, that's going to be, I think, your Republican primary turnout. Like, I don't see a lot of more moderate Republicans, or for that matter, more moderate Democrats on the other side coming out in primaries. Historically, we know that that's not really the case. So it's like, if David Perdue gets in the race with presumably an endorsement from Donald Trump, what do you do if you're Brian Kemp? Do you try to run even further to the right? Does that even get you more votes? And if so, what position does that put you in a general election? The calculus on this is really baffling to me.
Yeah, I just want to second everything you just said. It's a tough situation for someone like Kemp, who, I mean, you would think that he's got already gone as far right as he can go, but I remember, you know, the last election, some of those commercials that he put out, definitely trying to jazz up his base. And that's what primaries are about. It's a turnout game for your base. So,
yeah. And the thing is, just in terms of, from an actual policymaking standpoint, Governor Kemp has governed very far to the right. He's given the extreme right of the Republican Party a lot of the things that they want. You know, he's held fast on Medicaid expansion, for example. He has held, very firm on not doing anything about mask mandates or vaccination mandates. So he's doing a lot of stuff that the extreme right of the base want him to do. They're just not acknowledging it because he didn't overturn the results of an election a year ago. And that could very well end up being very problematic for him in a potential Republican primary against David Perdue if Perdue chooses to run.
Yeah, and if you actually believe the election was stolen, I can understand that. I can understand wanting someone who will make sure that the will of the people is fulfilled. So, but the problem is, it's just not true. You know, the election wasn't stolen. Biden won fair and square. But if you actually believe that it was stolen, yeah, that's a big issue.
Well, that'll be the last word for this week. That's all the time we have. And I do want to thank my panelists, Chris Dowd from Athens Politics Nerd, and our own senior producer, Martin Matheny.
Every day, NPR's All Things Considered includes news that keeps you ahead of the curve.
If this issue is not important enough for us to draw a line in the sand, what issue is?
Plus, the unexpected.
The wing, the skin, the neck, the heart, you're making chicken meatballs, cooking the knee cartilage.
All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Alexia Ridley. In 2016, the Athens Well-Being Project administered its first survey to gain a deeper understanding of the needs of the Athens community. And 3 years after the second questionnaire, the Athens Well-Being Project is now back with its third survey. Jacob Lambeck serves as the project manager of the Athens Well-Being Project. Dr. Grace Bagwell Adams is the principal investigator, and Megan Bramlett is a doctoral fellow. Welcome to Athens News Matters.
Absolutely. Thank you, Alexia.
To start, can you tell me the overall mission of the Athens Well-Being Project? And Grace, I'll direct that to you.
So the Athens Well-Being Project mission really is about getting timely, relevant data into the hands of each of the major institutions in our community that make policy, that implement policy, and that deliver services to the citizens, not just of Clark County, but citizens of a much larger region. So that hopefully helps them make better decisions that are data-driven, and also to ultimately, in the long run, increase well-being in our community.
There are a lot of questions related to police and policing. How do these fit into your mission, and what do you hope to learn from these questions? And maybe, Megan, I can have you start on that one.
Sure. So
The ACCPD is a stakeholder. They assist us with funding, survey distribution, things like that. We work with them or have historically worked with them when we've been out in the field. And the questions that are specifically related to police, policing, and 911 are provided actually by the police department. They use the answers, the responses to those questions for their accreditation process. So we've traditionally had a suite of questions around community safety, and we have in all three iterations, and we'll continue to do so.
They are required as a police department to actually collect information on community perceptions of their service delivery for their officers and for their 911 telecommunications. Chief Spurl, who is the partner that sits at our table, has been very engaged in the process of building the survey instrument and is interested in the data, not just for those external reasons of meeting accreditation, but also really to drive a deeper understanding of the community that they serve and use that as they pursue more professional development for their officers. So I'm grateful for his partnership and leadership, and I think that he's just doing an exceptional job in really engaging with this opportunity with the Athens Wellbeing Project to get meaningful data to support their work.
And when will the results from the survey be made available?
So we will finish data collection on 3.0 by mid-February, and we hope to have some preliminary findings that begin to come out by the end of March, beginning of April. And we'll do that kind of in stages as those analyses are being conducted. I will say, Alexia, one thing I want to note for the audience is that one of the things that I think makes Athens Wellbeing Project really special is the attention that we give to underrepresented groups in our community. We, in addition to sampling or collecting data from single family homes across the community, there are four groups that we've identified as what we call our special populations. And they're special because they are historically the groups that have been really difficult to hear from for a variety of reasons. And for that reason, because they've been left out sort of systematically from previous data collection attempts, it takes more time, intention, and planning to really make sure we get those groups adequately represented. Those four groups include homeless and transitional families, public housing residents that live in the Athens Housing Authority, who are all, of course, low income because they must be low income in order to qualify for that type of housing, Latino families, which compose a significant portion of our population in the community, but have historically been underrepresented in many of our data sources, and also older adults who are living in assisted living facilities. So those voices are really important, just as important as all the other voices that normally make their way into the data that we have. But again, we really pay attention to those four groups because in addition to being historically underrepresented, they're also some of the most vulnerable groups that are in need of connection to social and healthcare services. And so in order to really inform our stakeholders at the table who are serving these families every day as to what the needs are of that population or those populations, we really have to give time and attention to detail in collecting data. And so that just takes time. And so that's really what we will be focusing on in January to mid-February is those special populations finishing up that data collection. For that reason, it'll be the end of February and into March before we're able to start analyzing. And so early spring, we'll be reporting some of the findings.
What would you want the community to know about this project? It is certainly thorough.
Thank you, Alexia. I think what I want the community to know in the immediate short run is that it's really important for every single person to go to athenswellbeingproject.org and take the survey. We care about your family. We care about your household. And the way that we approach this project is ourselves as Athenians, not just researchers. And that's what I want you to hear is that, you know, I live in this county. I'm raising my family in this county. I want for the community to know that we have an extraordinary set of institutions that have invested in a process to hear from you because they care and because they want to know that the services that they're delivering to their clients, to their patients, are really the best that they possibly can be.
I'll go ahead with something that isn't too terribly exciting, but I think is really important for folks to know. We ask a question at the beginning of the survey. We ask for an address. And I think data security and privacy is something that's incredibly important to people, which I completely understand and appreciate. And I share that opinion. I think it's important for folks to know that the reason that we ask for an address is one, for deduplication. If somebody decides to take the survey 15 times, we cannot count all 15 surveys. So we have to find a way to deduplicate responses. The second is for Clark County School District, who is one of our strongest supporters and champions. They do so much for us and we're so appreciative of that work. We produce elementary school zone reports. So it's important that we know where your house is. Once data are collected, we give responses an elementary school zone code, and the home addresses are completely eliminated from the data. And we are very serious about data security. We can't do this without the trust of the community. So we would never do anything to jeopardize that.
I also want to reinforce that the survey is immensely important, and that this survey data goes directly into the minds and ears of some of the largest institutions and stakeholders in this community: Clark County School District, the Athens-Clark County government, the University of Georgia, both area hospitals, the Athens Area Community Foundation, United Way of Northeast Georgia, and many more. These data are valuable to them. They are regularly used by them. They're regularly referenced by them. And this is many people's greatest chance to be able to share their experiences and their current state of well-being with us and with these stakeholders, and help us to paint a picture of what this community currently looks like and how we are doing, especially in the wake of the pandemic. My hope is that in the future, we can continue to collect this data because the end goal of the Athens Wellbeing Project is to be a longitudinal data set, one which can be examined over a long period of time so that we can reference each of these points, AWP 1.0, 2.0, 3.0, 10.0, and hopefully look back in time and be able to see all of the changes that our community has undergone, all of the struggles that we have faced, and all of the opportunities that we have arisen to.
Well said. Jacob Lambeck, Grace Bagwell Adams, and Megan Bramlett, thank you all for joining me today.
Thank you, Alexia.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Jacob Lambeck serves as the project manager of the Athens Wellbeing Project. Dr. Grace Bagwell Adams is the principal investigator, and Megan Bramlett is a doctoral fellow.
As the coronavirus pandemic took hold, many of us turned to telemedicine to meet our healthcare needs. But using technology to help address mental health concerns brings its own opportunities as well as its own set of challenges. Allison Salerno brings us the story.
The COVID-19 pandemic changed how we shop, how we learn, how we worship, and how we go to therapy. A new class this semester at the University of Georgia School of Social Work is helping the next generation of mental health professionals navigate this new world.
I'm Shannon Malutnock, and I'm a field coordinator at the UGA School of Social Work. So I'm teaching a telemental health class, and obviously telemental health has become really a big deal in the past year and a half. And prior to that, it was kind of the slow, dormant way of doing social work and way of engaging with clients. But then because of COVID, the needs there to really train social workers on how to engage with clients through technology and telehealth purposes. And so the telemental health class covers not just how to do it, how to take this field that is very person-focused and face-to-face, but translate that through technology, but then also the ethics behind it, because it is so rapidly changing of how, as a field, do we engage with that and make sure that we're doing right by our clients.
They're learning about what's known as telemental health. Counseling is happening online, either through an app or a platform set up to make sure clients keep their privacy and get the help they need. Thomas Karani is a student in the class. He grew up in rural Lincolnton, about an hour northwest of Augusta. He thinks telemental health could be one way to reach residents in need.
I really took this because I saw what lack of providers looks like. Lincolnton, Augusta, all of that, there just isn't a very large base of providers there. And if it happened where I grew up, it's got to be happening in other places too. So I see a lack of providers and think to myself, maybe the solution is for the providers to not have to live out there.
The promise of telemental health has always been that the technology will allow social workers to reach rural residents and other people with challenges going to in-person counseling sessions. That's not always the case. Social work student Tamika Barber of Morrow talked in a recent class about what she's seeing on the ground in her social work internship.
Because there is a vast divide when it comes to the availability of Wi-Fi and computer access and understanding how to use it. And so now that although this wonderful teletherapy is available, it's not really to everyone.
Karani is interning with an agency that serves people who lack housing. He's seeing the challenges too.
Now, we provide phones that are not great,
yeah,
and we provide a limited amount of data every month through the agency. The trouble is, if they know how to work the phone, now we show them, but retaining that much information is hard for anybody. If they know how to work the phone, and if they can open the app and remember their credentials to log in, and be somewhere that they can actually do it, the signal in the areas that the unhoused people tend to not be hassled in Augusta is horrendous. Mm-hmm. It ends up being a convenience for the people that we've kind of got into the maintenance stage of case management, but people that need intervention, it's useless.
Professor Malutnak said 10 years ago, telemental health was seen as a less than optimal way to do counseling. She didn't like it herself.
Years ago, back, I guess it was like 2012, I had seen a couple of clients through telemental health and through a platform. And at that point, it was really clanky and the connection was, it was all the things you would expect it to have been. I didn't like it. They didn't love it. It was usually used with, for my experience, with clients who were living too far away to come to the office or had different reasons why they couldn't come into the office. But then after those clients, I have had not offered it at all. And now I'm 100% online.
Professor Malutnak hopes the students gain not only comfort with telemental health services, but also develop critical thinking skills about this new technology. The next generation of social workers, the ones in school now, are at an obvious advantage, Professor Malutnak says. They've been learning remotely, taking internships remotely, and are poised to offer therapy remotely.
They have a lot more training in some ways than the social workers who have been out there working, because they've had the experience of being online already on the receiving end through school. So they have, I would say, in some situations, more experience than others.
For WUGA News, this is Allison Salerno.
WUGA News is sponsored in part by the WUGA Community Advisory Council, dedicated and involved individuals who help WUGA stay connected with our listeners, community organizations, and issues in the Athens area. Learn more at WUGA.org. This is Athens News Matters. I'm Alexia Ridley.
And I'm Chris Shoup. Drive through the roundabout at the heart of Danielsville, Georgia, population 600 or so, and you'll see freshly painted murals on all four sides of an old stucco building. This is the work of Color the World Bright, a group of mostly University of Georgia students and alumni, guided by Professor Joseph Norman.
Sort of create and recreate a series of images and illustrations. For example, We're putting their logo on the building. We're recreating a huge Coca-Cola sign.
Color the World Bright began over a decade ago as a chance for students to make some extra money to help pay for study abroad programs, Norman says. Since then, the group has completed dozens of murals all over Georgia. Jackie Robinson in Cairo, Janet Harmon Bragg, the first black female pilot in Griffin, and around Athens, you may recognize the bulldog on the side of the Waffle House on Eppsbridge Parkway, or maybe even Albert Einstein on Broad Street. This mural in Danielsville, commissioned by MedLink, is really a series of murals. It includes, as Norman mentioned, a Coca-Cola sign and the MedLink logo, but it also has the historic front of the R.H. Daniel General Store, complete with faux bricks and a series of murals inspired by the iconic mid-century American artist Norman Rockwell, but with a twist.
They are reimagined so that they will include more diverse populations, so it reflects more of what America is now than what Norman Rockwell had perceived what America was back when he was working for the Saturday Evening Post.
As a professor at UGA's Lamar Dodd School of Art, Norman guides the group, but the students are heavily involved in every step of the process, especially one in particular, Katie Itzen.
I'm the project manager for the group, so just worked my way up the ladder, basically.
Itzen joined Color the World Bright like so many other students involved.
I took Professor Norman's intermediate drawing class when I was at Georgia, and he took me under his wing. Invited me to the group. I guess he decided he saw something in me.
Another student, Alondra Arevalo, the assistant project manager, helps Katie with planning murals.
I do more of the design work and talking to the commissioners about what they want on their mural. And then when I meet with them in person, I get to learn about time frames, when we can come, how much it costs for supplies, our time, and just get everything prepared before a job happens. And it bleeds into my own work at the art school because I know how much time is, like how much it's worth.
Students learning the business of making art is a highlight. Members like Itzen, who is also an art teacher, says Norman has taught her about how to make money from her art skills, as well as how to be an example of a working artist to her students.
It's not like I'm over here making millions or anything. It's not that I'm just drowning in it. It's still feasibly making some sort of money. But I was determined. Like I said, he's a great example that it's possible. And I feel like that gives me the power to be an example to my students. You know, it's possible, it's feasible, you can do it.
Meredith Lakeen, a former Color the World Bright member, was brought in as a skilled artist to paint the Rockwell-inspired murals. Lakeen describes one of the changes made to the paintings.
It is of a nurse with a little boy, and the nurse is white, and in the original painting, the little boy is also white. And she's about to take his temperature or look in his throat or something like that. And in our painting, we did a little black boy.
And what did passersby think about the re-envisioning of an American classic?
One man in particular did talk about how, it was interesting that the way we decided to change the paintings was very interesting, given the context of, you know, where we are in the South, and that it would be, you know, really, I thought it was great that we did that.
Besides guiding and mentoring the Color the World Bright crew, Joseph Norman is an artist in his own right whose work can be found in esteemed museums and public collections like the Museum of Modern Art New York, the Museum of Fine Arts Boston, and the National Gallery, among others. When discussing his own work, Norman says,
one of the things that I think artists have to do is to try to illuminate the purpose of man's existence, have to sort of maybe speak truth to power and try to maybe make a social commentary on the epoch in which they live.
In his own art, Norman also likes when the audience is challenged.
I also would like the audience to work a little bit. Then they look at it carefully and they say, ah, that's what that is. And so I think it becomes art universal.
And isn't that what murals are? An opportunity for the viewer to stop and ponder. What is this all about? Norman and Idson say there isn't a shortage of viewers stopping, pondering, and showing their appreciation. Idson again.
I don't think I can even count on two hands how many people have come up to the group and come up to us individually and told us, great job, this looks amazing. Or people who are a little bit older who have stopped by to tell us how many times they went into the store as children or as teenagers. You know, they start to reminisce in front of you, and it's really cool to get all of their history and their personal perspectives on the town. But seeing those communities come together and how much they care about us coming in really makes a statement about how much they care about these murals impacting their communities.
It took about a month from the moment the first paintbrush touched the wall in downtown Danielsville to the completion of the project. The murals are dry now, and this corner of the world is a little brighter as Norman and his team move on to the next project.
You've been listening to Athens News Matters from WUGA News. Our producers are Martin Matheny, Gene Davis, Devin Zwald, Robin Whetstone, Kara Nelson, and Abby Buston. The opinions expressed on this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of WUGA or the University of Georgia.
Don't forget, you can listen back to today's stories and past episodes over at WUGA.org. And you can catch up with us on the WUGA app, available for Apple and Android, wherever you get your apps. Or find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We're at WUGA-FM. For Alexia Ridley, I'm Chris Shoup. As always, thanks for listening to Athens News Matters from WUGA News. Have a safe weekend, and we'll see you right back here next week.